Kansas native Savannah Rogers began her now famous TED Talk like this.
When I was 12, I exclusively wanted to watch Ben Affleck movies. It's an incredibly specific thing for a child to demand. But Ben Affleck was the star of the 2003 superhero film Daredevil. Naturally, I was in love with him. My living room was home to a year-long event, the Ben Affleck Film Festival, where I was the only attendee.
This is a very lighthearted way to start what's actually a serious discussion about gay representation in movies, because it was this quirky obsession with Ben Affleck that led Savannah to the movie Chasing Amy, and it was Chasing Amy that got Savannah through a really rough patch of adolescence. Savannah's talk, The Rom-Com That Saved My Life, has been viewed by people all over the country, including filmmaker Kevin Smith, who made Chasing Amy in the 1990s. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear that story now. Savannah Rogers, good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. So until yesterday, your talk had just been kind of shared organically because the TED organization hadn't officially tweeted it out or anything like that. And even so, it had gotten lots of attention. But yesterday, it did get shared through the TED Talk's social media channels. What happened?
A lot of homophobic comments,
really?
But it's
so
all right.
Sorry to hear that.
No, but it was great. I mean, more people watched it, which was the whole goal. And so, you know, I got some, you know, nice tweets yesterday, and it was just really nice that the TED Social team shared it for Pride Month. It was great.
You did a residency with TED Talks to develop the story, and you applied for it knowing that you wanted to tell this exact story of how Chasing Amy got you through the cruelty and isolation of being outed by your peers before you had even an inkling about your own sexuality.
It's an interesting way to think about it, because I just felt like everybody knew before I really knew. You know, I didn't really have any concept of, you know, really what that meant. I mean, my mom's best friend was gay, and my mom had always told me, you know, if you're gay, it's okay. And I was like, great, I don't really know. And then I saw this movie, Chasing Amy, and things started to make sense with the fluidity of sexuality.
Can you pick up where we left off at the beginning of this show, where you're a 12-year-old who just happens to be obsessed with Ben Affleck movies?
Yeah, gay rights icon Ben Affleck, that
yeah.
One. Yeah, I saw Daredevil in the movie theaters with my mom at like age 8, and that really kind of set my world on fire in terms of like interests. You know, got really into comic books, but you know, and then like the X-Men movies were coming out, and my mom was showing me all that, and basically I just really latched on to Daredevil because it was the first one that I had really seen. I'd seen it in a movie theater. And it was a really cool experience. And so then I was like, oh, I'd like to watch everything Ben Affleck's done. Thank you very much. And, then that eventually led to, you know, my mom and I going to this like store called Half Price Books and, looking for Ben Affleck movies every few weeks, to keep me entertained.
And so you find Chasing Amy, and I'm just going to give a quick synopsis. You can add if you think I'm missing anything, because you watched this movie a lot more than I did. It's a 90s movie starring Ben Affleck as a straight guy who falls in love with a lesbian, although she's somewhat fluid. And they're both comic book artists. They both have a lot of fun, snappy banter. And that includes some very non-subtle dialogue where she explains to him how being gay works.
Yeah, I mean, I think you nailed most of that. You know, I've seen it like 200 times easily. So, I mean, basically how I describe it, and this is how I describe it in the TED Talk, is a straight guy played by Ben Affleck falls in love with a self-identified lesbian, and the movie is centered around their evolving relationship. And, you know, it's a very nuanced kind of thing, though, because especially when it came out in 1997, there wasn't a ton of, like, pansexual, bisexual visibility. And they don't use the word bisexual once in the movie, but the way that she describes her sexuality really falls in line with people who experience the fluidity of sexuality, which is interesting.
How exactly did this movie keep you afloat?
Well, I was having a really hard time. You know, I grew up in Olathe, and there were a lot of great things about that. But also, it's a fairly, you know, socially conservative area. At least it was when I was growing up there. There was not a lot of nuance in terms of LGBTQ issues at that time in Olathe. And I know since there have been, like, gay-straight alliances and PFLAG groups established at a lot of the high schools. But, you know, when I was, you know, growing up, there weren't very many resources. And, you know, so when I came across this movie, after begging my mom to let me watch it, it really became like a touchstone. And at first I didn't really know why. I was like, oh, it's a romantic movie. But, you know, like as I, you know, grew up, it really became a lifeline in the way that it represented LGBTQ people as good. And, you know, I didn't really know that there were other queer movies. And so it was an interesting time. But I mean, that movie, you know, I watched it every day for a couple of months, I think, and driving my mom crazy with the DVD music.
I thought about playing the music to just be like, most of you don't know what movie this references, but our guest today definitely does. So the thing that you talk about in the TED Talk is really that when you talk about that these characters are gay people who are good, that's in contrast to the way, like, slurs were being thrown at you and presenting this identity that you hadn't even had time to consider in a really negative light.
Completely. You know, I feel like I've blocked out a lot of my childhood at this point. Not in, you know, like specifically like middle school, high school. I think I've like intentionally forgotten a lot at this point. But just to kind of move on from, you know, whatever trauma was still manifesting, you know, I'm trying to let it go. And I think the TED Talk did help me let it go. But Chasing Amy, you know, a lot of the epithets I was hearing at school were used in that film. But the people who were using them, you know, it was oftentimes queer people who were using them in the movie. Or if somebody was using them in a homophobic context, you know, they weren't correct. The movie didn't really let it slide, in my opinion. And it was just, it was cathartic to see, you know, queer people thriving at a certain point when I was watching it the first 200 times I saw it.
Why did you want to share that with a wider audience?
Well, I think, you know, I think I make movies perhaps in pursuit of the way that Chasing Amy made me feel the first time I saw it, right? You know, I try to bring a little levity and a little joy into the work that I do, because I think we see a lot of, like, really sad queer and trans movies. And I'd really like to, you know, tell stories that are not about the worst things that have happened to our community. You know, other people can make it difficult to be LGBTQ identified sometimes, but there's a lot of joy there. And I haven't seen that experience represented nearly as much. And perhaps that's also why Chasing Amy resonates with me, is because it's not about the worst things that have happened to these people. They are good. They are intelligent. They are good at their jobs. And, you know, it's not about necessarily sexuality. It just happens to be, you know, a catalyst for, you know, the story. And so, I mean, back to your question, why did I want to share this with everyone? I mean, when they asked me in my interview for the TED residency, if you had to give a TED talk tomorrow, what would it be about? And I pitched my documentary, Chasing Amy, to them, telling them about, you know, how this movie deeply affected me. But it's controversial among a lot of LGBTQ people. You know, I wanted
why
to talk about representation.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it's controversial because it depicts a self-identified lesbian, you know, being in a romantic and sexual relationship with Ben Affleck. He's not exactly the gay rights icon I imagined him to be. So it's controversial for that reason. And I think it upset a lot of specifically lesbian women in the 90s and since then. You know, if you look at a lot of the discourse around it among LGBTQ cultural critics, it's not, you know, portrayed positively.
So that nonetheless was a lifeline for you, and you wanted to tell this story. Yeah, as you say in the TED Talk, that when we talk about representation in movies and in pop culture in general, that this isn't just a frivolous thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly saved my life. And, you know, I mean, by virtue of Chasing Amy existing, you know, I'm now a filmmaker, and ideally I'll get to a point where, you know, maybe some 12-year-old in Kansas will see my film and feel a little better about themselves.
When you say, you know, that it saved your life, I know that we don't want to, I know that you're trying to somewhat let go of the worst things that happened to you, and I don't need you to, like, drag out every trauma for our listeners, but what do you exactly mean by it saved your life?
Well, I mean, you know, I was a suicidal 12-year-old, you know, I was, I had really deep issues with anxiety and depression from ages 12 to 19. I really struggled to accept myself, you know, given, you know, how people responded to the idea of me being queer. And it wasn't until I went to college and, you know, was fully embraced by my family. Not that, you know, my family was ever anything but supportive. But when I finally could come out to them and talk to them, and I had a support system and, you know, my friends and my, you know, future partner and my family, that I felt like I could really be myself. And suppressing that part of myself for so long and being so afraid, you know, to come out to people who I knew wouldn't care, you know, and they wouldn't make a big deal out of it, or they would just love me anyway, you know, that was the hardest part. And so, I mean, this movie really, it gave me hope, you know, and I think that's the power of our favorite movies. I mean, I think if you talk to a lot of people, they have a movie that just fundamentally changed them, or a movie, or, you know, maybe even now like a podcast, you know, their media matters. What we, you know, take in ultimately affects us and shapes us. You know, entertainment is a huge export of the United States. You know, we are inundated with it constantly. And I think the more positive portrayals of LGBTQ people there are, the more likely that we're going to help some kid out who needs it.
Who needs some self-love.
Yeah.
Do you think that the experience you had in Olathe is still what it would be today?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I mean, you know, right now the Olathe City Council is refusing to hear anything about passing an LGBTQ non-discrimination ordinance in the city. You know, there are still issues there, you know, and I really hope that my hometown can come around on these issues and that it can create a fundamentally safe place for LGBTQ people to live and work and raise their kids. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done. You know, I can't speak to what a high schooler may be going through, but I feel pretty certain that things have not changed nearly enough to where, you know, people feel safe being out necessarily in Kansas.
So the other thing I really want to talk about before we go is what's happened since this TED Talk was released. You've heard from a lot of people, including filmmaker Kevin Smith, who made Chasing Amy, which, as you say, you have watched at least 200 times.
Yeah.
What was that like? What did he say?
Kevin has been so generous with me. Basically, he saw the TED Talk within an hour of it coming out, which is a testament to the power of Twitter, honestly. I had some friends share it. They heard their friend shared it who knew Kevin, and then Kevin watched it, tweeted it out, and got it a major boost in terms of views. But also, you know, he says in his tweet that that's on his, like, Twitter feed, that, you know, he cried when I said I was a filmmaker now. And he said that he'd be happy to help out with the documentary and that he knew a few people. So Kevin has been really, really generous with me. He has just been a huge, you know, source of support in this. And, you know, he's really excited to do an interview, I think, and for the documentary.
And so your documentary, it's called Chasing Amy. And is it basically an expansion of the TED Talk on some level?
On some level, yeah. Chasing Amy, I thought that was the first title I came up with. I thought it sounded stupid. And then everybody subsequently came up to me and was like, you know what you should name your documentary? And, you know, I'm expanding on a lot of ideas I talk about in the TED Talk, but I'm really digging into, you know, what the culture was like in 1997 when Chasing Amy came out, and what it was like for people to receive that then versus how it could be perceived now. I initially started with the premise that perhaps Chasing Amy would be received differently among a younger generation like mine. And then I quickly found out that I couldn't even back that up anecdotally just because not enough people my age have seen Chasing Amy. But now that it's on streaming and now with the TED Talk, more people my age are, you know, saying, oh, I watched this for the first time because of your TED Talk and I really liked it. Or I have complicated feelings about it. I'd love to talk to you about it, which is a dream come true for me.
Savannah Rogers, congratulations on all the publicity. And also, thank you so much for talking with us about your own story today.
Thank you so much.
Savannah is a filmmaker whose TED Talk about the movie Chasing Amy and its impact on her life as an adolescent in Olathe is online at TED.com. It's called The Rom-Com That Saved My Life. I'm Gina Kaufman, and up next, we're talking about the thing we can never get enough of, sleep. That's coming up. For some of us, getting a good night's sleep requires an elaborate set of rituals. Screens off, white noise, essential oils perfuming the pillowcase, nice cool room, heavy blanket, counting backwards. There's even a sleep podcast specifically created to bore you to sleep. It's excruciatingly boring and really popular. We do these things because sleep makes everything better. It's good for our health, our cognition, even our relationships. But you're not the only one who cares how much you sleep. Your employer might be taking an interest too. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're revisiting a conversation we had last year with people who are trying to make their work culture more compatible with good sleep habits. We'll start with Sean Yu with us from Garmin. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
So you make wearable devices that can track people's stress levels?
Yes, we do. Yeah, basically we measure people's not only heart rate, but also a phenomenon that's called heart rate variability. And that way we have the way to monitor or to measure people's autonomic nervous system responses. And that's just a very phenomenal behavior that we can tap into people's sleep, and not only sleep, but also their daily activities.
So how does monitoring stress throughout the day help people manage specifically sleep at night?
Basically, if people, well, as we all know, that if we are stressful during the daytime, that may definitely impact our sleep quality. And not only that, maybe a lot of people don't know that the late night coffee or the big snack or even the alcohol at night would affect our stress level. And that would actually appear during our stress level during sleep.
So wait, a snack that I have at night might stress me out?
Maybe. If you have a big snack at night, then that your body needs to digest it. You know, you need to cope with that kind of a big snack, and that may delay your recovery during sleep. But mainly just the effects are from stimulants such as alcohol and caffeine.
So how do people use the information? I mean, how do you use information about your stress, about your sleep, to help you sleep better?
From the genesis of our Garmin's wearable, we have a way to track people's sleep. So we have a way to know that people's onset and termination of the sleep. But moving from there, then we realize that it's not just the sleep duration or deep or light sleep that affects people's quality of life, but also their daily going. And for example, if you have a small children like I do, then probably you didn't really get enough of restful moments at night before sleep, and that would definitely make some impacts to the to your sleep quality, and that would delay a little bit of your sleep or recovery moments during your sleep, and that would show up on your Garmin profile as well.
So how does this work? How does the product itself work, and then how does a customer interact with it?
Mm-hmm. So right now, Garmin has the best-in-class heart rate monitor. So basically, it's just some gadgets that you wear on your wrist. It's very comfortable, very low profile. And then with this heart rate monitor, we measure heart rate, heart variability, like I said. And that's a high resolution B2B heart rate. And that way, basically, we just say that, hey, even your heart rate is low. However, we notice some nuances.
So there are, you guys are actually there receiving this data and responding to it.
That's correct. Right. So not only heart rate, but also the device equipped with some motion sensor. So when you toss and turns, well, this device knows it as well.
And you, like other human beings, know it. So like you know when someone's tossing and turning. You know when someone's maybe getting up to use the restroom in the night. That kind of stuff?
Well, Garmin doesn't really look into individual data like that. So we have a very stringent protection or policy on accessing people's data, real data. So mainly your data is secured and protected. And that data cannot be accessed by any unrelated personnel like me as an engineer. I developed the product, but I have access to your or any individual's user's data to it.
But someone is using that data for, right?
Someone, mainly the user using that data. Yeah.
So, you know, what does this technology do for people? Do you have any have people been using it long enough to be able to say that they're able to use this data to sleep better? Because the kind of awareness you're talking about, for example, like when I have trouble sleeping, if I look at the clock and see how long I've been awake, that is pretty much the worst thing I can do because that stresses me out. There's nothing I can do about the fact that I've been awake for maybe 2 hours. You know, does knowing help? Or does it maybe make it worse?
Yeah, you're right. Knowing is actually the first step, right? You cannot really improve something you cannot measure. So our goal is that we provide you information that help you to make a better decision in this wellness domain.
But like the example with small children, what are you going to do about not getting rest in the evening? You can't just be like, I'm not going to take care of my children.
Yeah, that's right. That's a perfect example. But maybe we can just try to make some gradual adjustment to it. However, from the Garmin point of view, we don't really want to like enforce people that you should have this schedule, you should have that schedule. But we provide information, we provide data, so that people can react to it. So it's more like that. So recently, we received a lot of report. The user, real user, report saying that, hey, why my stress is so high even when I was in bed when I'm asleep. Like, hey, I don't really have a restful moment until 3 a.m. What's going on? And then we just say, hey. Did you drink some Red Bulls before that, or did you use alcohol? And a lot of times that's just the small information or small question like that would just help people to make some adjustment. Even just like, okay,
the
I should cut back.
The alcohol one might be surprising to a lot of people because the general assumption is that that relaxes you.
Yeah, that's exactly. However, alcohol may kind of make you drowsy or make you dizzy, but it's actually not a good way to put you to sleep. It's more like a sedative than an enhancer for your sleep. So, and that would actually reflect it to the person's heart rate and heart rate variability. And that's why we see that, hey, this is a high stress even when I was in bed. What's going on? And maybe that also explains why when you wake up, you still feel a little bit like insufficient of sleep and you just feel a little bit
maybe hungover.
Exactly. If you have too much, then maybe that's the hungover.
How are your sleep habits?
I have to admit that my sleep habit is not that good. I'm in the same camp with small children at home. But not only that, I'm actually competing with some other things, effects, such as keeping up with of my work and also Netflix. So, yeah.
Two things you must keep up with.
Exactly.
Work and
the show that I have. So I have to admit that I have to put some sweat in my sleep hygiene. I have to make sleep as my priority.
Sleep is supposed to be relaxing, not like a labor of, you know, like I got to put some sweat into this.
Exactly. But to be honest, that some people may think that, yeah, my schedule is flexible. But the truth is that they actually sacrifice sleep to make their schedule flexible. And in order to have a better sleep, we should have a very rigorous, I shouldn't say religious, schedule for sleep. And that would just give you at least 7 to 9 hours of good quality of sleep. And that will help you to get a new day better.
But why don't you do that? I mean, you're this person who has like more data than anyone could imagine on this. There has to be something about that Netflix show that is of value to you, or something about your work schedule that just won't budge.
I actually started doing that. I try to keep a better sleep hygiene since I working on the project related to sleep, and we improve or enhance our current sleep features on our wearables. That's just helped me to be more aware, especially after listening to a lot of stories from our users, that like testimonies of how our products will help them to get better sleep. Now I'm keeping up. But it's not like a night and day change. Sleep is just like you mentioned, Gina, that you cannot say that, hey, I want to fall asleep and just boom, and then you fall asleep.
Yeah,
right
that would
away.
Be nice.
Exactly. That would be nice, right? But nobody could do that, right? So it has to be has some sort of like gradual change. And I try to increase my sleep amount gradually, day by day, something like that.
But it is ironic that, you know, when you talk about your work keeping you up, in particular, when your work is helping people sleep. I mean, at Garmin, do you... Are there interventions for employees and their sleep? I mean, this is a company watching all kinds of people sleep. What about employees?
Right. To be honest, it's actually spontaneous. I don't really receive a lot of emails from my colleagues, from my supervisors. My managers don't send me emails at night. So we actually very emphasize the work-life balance at Garmin.
So is there an actual rule about no emails at night?
Well, we don't have the like a written rule say no emails at night, but one thing that I appreciate is that as a time extended employee at Garmin, we have a flexible hours. So it's like plus minus 1 hour from 8 to 5. If I go to work at 7 a.m., I can leave for work for 4. If that day I feel particularly drowsy, I may be able to walk into my office at night, but I just need to leave for home a little bit later. So that's something I appreciate Garmin has. That's a great policy to help me to catch up some sleep when I need it.
That's really cool. Let's talk to Haley Proffitt about this. She's the senior well-being specialist at Garmin. Hi, Haley.
Hi.
How much does your company think that workers' sleep patterns matter to the success of the business?
We absolutely know it's important. We know that it isn't just a business case. We can directly tie it to productivity and performance. We know that they're going to be better performers when they're more cognitively restful when they come in. But it's also kind of the bigger picture on, just as Sean had mentioned, this work-life integration concept. You know, we don't have a written policy that emails can't happen past 8:10 p.m. But people are very respectful of that. We want to give them that space so that they can make that choice for themselves, and hopefully they're creating those healthy sleep patterns.
But
at
is
home.
Someone there saying, actively encouraging people to stop working after a certain time?
You know, I think it's going to be very dependent on the business segment that they're representing as well, because we are an international company. And so we do have various times to consider. We have various industries that we're serving and representing. So we're very cognizant of that. But I would also say throughout all of our companies and all of our locations that it's also about the education and awareness, and knowing that the leaders that we do have in the organization do care about their people enough to say your health and well-being is a priority.
You know, you mentioned having offices all over the world in different time zones. I wonder if office cultures differ in terms of how they accommodate or encourage sleep.
Absolutely. You know, a prime example is we have multiple locations in Taiwan, and many businesses there, including the Garmin locations, have sleeping decks. They have sleeping rooms. They have lots of opportunities for those individuals to go take restful times throughout their day. I think that it's definitely
like,
a cultural block
a
here. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's going to be a slow shift that we start seeing in the Americas, but it's going to be coming. This is a trend. Sleep is important to employers. We're starting to be able to make that correlation directly. So while a napping room isn't something that we do have on site right now in the United States, especially at headquarters, we are creeping down the path of, you know, we have meditation rooms and we have other quiet spaces for our associates to go when they are on site. And again, are we providing them enough opportunities and education so that when they're at home, they're also taking their own responsibility and saying, hey, sleep's a priority to me.
Is this when you take initiatives like meditation rooms? I mean, as you talk about creeping towards stuff like napping rooms, is that something that you have to sell people on from a business standpoint?
Yeah. I'm going to say yes. When you're going into a corporate setting, especially, sometimes those conversations are going to be a little tough, a little odd for some cultures, but there's also going to be others that are right on board immediately, and that's okay too. Even if you are trying to sell it in certain cultural situations, it's a progressive thing, and so it's not going to be something that happens immediately overnight. It's going to be, what are baby steps that we can do to get to a place like that?
Haley Proffitt is the wellness specialist at Garmin. We've also been chatting with their product designer, Sean Yu, who measures other people's sleep while sleeping badly himself. We'll pick right back up with this discussion after the break with a sleep doctor. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Today, we're talking about sleep and the workplace. Dr. Jason Graff is here now. He's the medical director of sleep disorders at St. Luke's Hospital. Hi, Jason.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So we all probably have this intuitive sense that getting a good night's sleep improves our functioning, but what do we know about how sleep really affects our lives, like when we're awake?
It's really individualized, and The short answer is that the duration and quality of sleep that you need is enough for you to feel rested and alert throughout the day, not fall asleep when bored for 5 minutes or when you sit down on the couch or watch your favorite TV show. So that is one topic of debate, in that a lot of people are fixated on getting 8 hours of sleep but may feel completely rested after 6 or 7.
But maybe so, they don't know what really rested is.
Right.
like if they've always been chronically undersleeping.
Right. Two-thirds of Americans report getting insufficient sleep during the work week. And chronic sleep insufficiency often leads to sort of an insidious onset of problems that become chronic, and that person may think that I'm getting older, this is how I'm supposed to feel at this age. You know, I get up multiple times a night for my kids, I'm not supposed to feel rested. But how you feel may not actually be as good as you can feel if you had better sleep.
I read in the New York Times that Americans on the whole are getting about 18 minutes more sleep a night than we used to about 10 years ago. That's not very much, 18 minutes, but I mean, they say that that's coming from the time we save making purchases online, possibly, instead of running errands, like that we're not watching less TV or doing, you know, like we're not, it's not an active sacrifice of something that we are deliberately making. Do we fail to, like, recognize how important this is?
I think in general, we have failed at that, but awareness is increasing. You know, the colleagues we've already spoken with, you know, point to the trend of large corporations recognizing how sleepy employees are less productive, they're more prone to accidents. And depending on the business, it's hard to quantify, but one estimate that I read was that more than $63 billion is lost each year because of mistakes made and poor productivity by employees that were sleep deprived.
What is your sense of how people's work environments can either help or make things worse?
As Haley was kind of mentioning with Garmin, some of those initiatives have to come from the top down. If your boss is constantly sending you emails and asking you to do stuff at 3 a.m., that sends a culture that everyone has to be ready to work on a 24-hour cycle and that your individual sleep isn't important. So at least from a corporate wellness point of view, that's a culture that has to be created from the top down. But I think individually, as more and more of our work becomes portable, you can take your work home on your handheld device or your computer. In my experience, it becomes harder and harder to set the boundary of when the bell rings at 5 and I go home, work is done and I do whatever I want. I take care of my family. I exercise. As a physician, we are pushed more and more to be productive. You know, there's a physician shortage. We have to see more and more patients. And we often take our charting and our computer work and we do it at home. And sometimes that bleeds into time when we would normally realize we should be sleeping.
Yeah, you know, that is an interesting issue. I mean, you are a sleep specialist, but you work in a field. I mean, hospitals are notorious for being really disruptive to employees' sleep schedules.
Right. We have to staff a hospital 24/7, and many of our personnel that work at night, when they're not working, there's a lot of stuff they have to do during the day. They shift back to a day schedule. They have to get their kids to school. Yet when their night shift comes up, they stay up all night and are probably less productive than they would be if they had a regular sleep schedule. So finding the fine balance with having to, you know, providing a good service, yet having rested employees that do quality of work is often difficult.
Yeah, I mean, is there an initiative like that to work on that at St. Luke's? Because, I mean, it does seem like a hospital is limited in what they can do. Patients do need care 24 hours a day. That's just the reality. But what kinds of steps can hospitals take?
Well, I've been at the St. Luke's Health System long enough to see some of the progress. You know, part of our wellness criteria in order to get discounts on our health insurance premiums involve getting enough sleep. Now, how much is enough? That kind of depends on the person, but it's becoming increasingly recognized.
Wait, you can just say I got enough sleep and that's enough, though?
Right. So
yeah.
It's sort of self-reported. It's not yet monitored. Someday, maybe
for a health
Sean
insurance
and our Garmin colleagues will help us with that.
Yeah. I mean, that does raise some interesting ethical questions, but I mean, assuming that it's with the employee's best interest in mind, what else? I mean, what other than those like health insurance discounts for people who are doing healthy things like sleeping enough at night by their own reports?
I think these initiatives are still in their infancy. I think that we're still in the process of raising awareness of how important sleep is for the, for the common American. We have more and more technology available to where you can get some more objective feedback on how you sleep, whether or not you're getting enough sleep. A lot of people, even though they will self-report that they're not getting enough sleep, objectively, they're getting even less than they think they're getting.
Wait, that's terrible.
Right. But I see patients all the time. They come in, they say they go to bed at a certain time, but they don't count that they're in bed, they check their email on the phone, notifications pop up, they check a couple more things, and they check the weather the next day, and they're actually falling asleep much later than they perceive. And sometimes they're shocked at the data that comes from their smart device or their sleep tracker software that shows that maybe they're not sleeping as well as they thought they were.
So what's your advice? I mean, do you have some just quick advice that people can take to heart? If their employers are not giving them some helpful things, what can we do to help ourselves?
Well, I think you have to be aware of a lot of the negative consequences of chronically being sleep deprived. And it's not just about your productivity at the workplace, although it has been shown that The sleepy employee is less likely to be productive and less likely to advance in companies. But you really have to look at it, look at some of the data, and that chronic sleep deprivation can increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. It reduces quality of life. It makes people more irritable. It can negatively affect all of your interpersonal relationships at home and at work.
But I have to tell you something. You are really stressing me out telling me these things. And I feel like I love sleep. I know sleep matters. And I still sometimes have trouble sleeping. And hearing all these things, like, God, it's affecting my relationships. And, like, it makes me feel really stressed out, which I don't think it is helpful to know how bad it is.
And that's the debate I sometimes have with my patients. They'll come in and they'll bring in sleep tracker data, and there'll be a lot of lines that suggest that they are not sleeping as deeply as they want to sleep. It starts with how you feel during the day. If you feel great during the day and you're not sleepy, then little bursts or periods of what your sleep tracker thinks is not restful sleep probably isn't clinically significant. If you feel tired during the day and are not rested, and you want to be able to monitor that yourself, then these devices can be very helpful. The difficult part is, how does the common consumer interpret that data, and what does it mean? Just like when Sean was speaking earlier, there are many medications, there are substances that you can take in, like caffeine or alcohol, that can affect the architecture of sleep and alter sleep tracking data. But ultimately, you need to make sleep a priority. It's really easy to think that you can compensate for poor sleep with caffeine, or I'm going to get a nap later, which may or may not really come to fruition.
If a nap does come to fruition, is that helpful, or does it not matter if it's not part of, like, the big chunk of sleep at night?
It can be helpful. A short nap in somebody who's chronically sleep deprived can be very refreshing. You just don't want to sleep so much during the day that it interferes with your ability to fall asleep later that night.
You know, I want to get back to sort of how the way we structure our work lives plays into all of this. For me, this is just as disrupted as my sleep has ever been by a job. I used to work at a coffee shop where some days of the week I did the early morning opening shift, which started at about 5:30 in the morning. And then there were other days of the week when I did the closing shift and didn't finish till like 11 at night. And it wasn't that one was so early I couldn't have done it, or the other was so late that it was a problem, but having my schedule all over the map like that was a real sleep disaster. And I don't know if there's any, like, medical information behind why we can't just sleep whenever we feel like it. I mean,
there is. The circadian rhythm, or our internal biologic clock, wants us to sleep when it's dark and be awake when it's light, as if we were living like cavemen. We just have work duties, family duties,
and
artificial lighting that allow us to fight against our own biology, and it's when we do that frequently at irregular intervals where we can feel even more sleep deprived depending on the time of day and what we're doing.
So Haley, like, scheduling seems like it would be a big part of this.
Yeah. So one thing that I really like to talk about, and I utilize the opportunity anytime at Garmin in classes we host and programs we have going on, is talking about a bedtime routine for adults. And it sounds so silly, but adults actually need it way more than kids. Kids are going to fall asleep. They're going to stay asleep, you know, for the most part. But adults take complete advantage of, we do have electronics, we have tablets, we have phones, we have computers, we have TVs, we have all of this around us all the time. We have these lights on all the time, you know, really talking about the shade of the lighting in the house. You know, are they dimming it? Are they reducing their screen time? Are they not consuming the alcohol? Are they incorporating workouts throughout the day that are the best time for them and their bodies? And are we really creating that bedtime routine? And so it's simplifying things enough so that they understand we've got to create an environment that's going to be conducive to sleep, so that we're not laying there, just as you mentioned, watching the time tick by and stressing over not falling asleep. Instead, have we prepared ourselves for sleep?
And does that start like at a point in the day when people are still at work at Garmin? Like when you talk about getting in a workout at the time that's best for your body, is it, do employees at Garmin have that freedom to say, the best time for my body to work out is 2. So sorry, meeting that happens at 2.
Right. Yeah. Honestly, yes. Sometimes that is this case and scenario. But I would say for the most part, we're very cognizant of, we do have jobs and jobs that we probably want to keep. So we know meetings are important. I will say that, again, it goes back to this culture conversation. Sleep is important. Workouts are important. Taking care of our own well-being is really a priority. So how do we make that work? How do we integrate that into our daily life and make it easy for us? The last thing we want to say, just as you had mentioned, is being stressed over this. We shouldn't be stressed about taking care of ourselves. It should just naturally be a priority.
What are the challenges to that in a corporate environment, even one where people have been sold on exactly the message you're stating? Because I think most human beings can hear what you're saying and say, yeah, that's how it should be. But there might be some really like immovable obstacles to that in terms of a company's bottom line.
Sure, absolutely. And I don't think we have time today to go into the millions of challenges that exist in every corporate environment. But that's also, you know, more broad spectrum. Every business, every organization is going to experience those. I think it's really looking at well-being in such a holistic manner that, again, it does need to fit naturally into your lifestyle, into your daily routine, whether it's raising kids, it's going to work, it's, you know, preparing your food. It is finding time throughout the day for the workout. But also not stressing ourselves out about it. You know, if you have the one cheeseburger, if you get a few hours less sleep one night, but you're building relationships, you had an event and you were with friends, you have to really look at it in that broader spectrum of, what am I doing for myself? And is this really going to impact me in meaningful, long-term ways that are helping my well-being?
You know, Sean, when you look at people's data, when you look at data in general, do the things that Haley's describing, like building relationships and things like that, do they play into an overall picture of how healthy and relatively stress-free a person is?
First of all, I have to say that the way we measure stress is actually the physiological stress. It's actually an integrated stress that combines emotional, psychological, and also physical stress. So we heard about this recommendation saying that, hey, you shouldn't exercise too close to your bedtime. That's because your body needs to cope with the aftermath of that. The second of all is that our wearable actually measure a lot of things, but we don't really have a lot of contextual information. We don't ask people about their personal life. We don't tap into that, hey, what did you do in the evening that makes you that, until a user spontaneously asks us about that. And to answer your question, that our big data team actually look into the metadata, which is totally depersonalized data, and then we just come up with some suggestion in general for a particular user based on the bigger user base. And again, that's just the data. We don't really say that, hey, this is something you should follow. We just say that, hey, in general, the average American get 8 hours of sleep, and now you're falling on the spectrum of this. Then you can do something about this.
But like, do you have data on whether, like, in terms of what triggers the physiological stress and what calms it? Like, is you know, Haley saying going out with friends and sacrificing that sleep might be a wash. Maybe that was worth it, even physically, in terms of your health.
I agree.
Does the data support that?
I agree. Yeah, yes. Because the stress that showed up is not the general perceived stress. It could be like excitement, and that would actually boost your energy up a little bit. And it's not just this instantaneous one that we look at. We have to look at, just like Haley said, we have to look at the bigger picture, because if the stress doesn't really last for a long period of time, that may not give you any of detrimental impact to your health, because that could just be because, hey, you need this excitement, you need this kind of boost for your social life, for your psychological aspect, to take care of self and also your family, and that wouldn't as far as I know, that wouldn't impact your sleep at night if that's just short bursts of the excitement moments.
You know, One last question for our doctor here. I mean, when we talk about what a work culture can do to help us sleep, in a perfect world, our bosses care how we sleep. They care about our well-being. And some people are lucky enough to be in that situation. Others are not. And sometimes your only advocate for your own well-being is you. And you were talking about how hard it is to, you know, go ahead and turn off the phone, even though you might have someone emailing you in the middle of the night with the expectation and a work culture that you're maybe going to answer that. How do you set your own limits? I mean, do you advise your patients on these things?
I do all the time, especially my patients that come in fatigued or have insomnia, that, you know, you just have to make sleep a priority. And, you know, part of what Sean was talking about, how he knows all the good sleep habits and admits that he doesn't follow them all the time, because we have families, we have multiple things pulling us in every direction. And you just have to create healthy habits. And sometimes your employer will encourage that and sometimes they won't. But I think that times are changing. We know more and more about the negative consequences of poor sleep, you know, especially in over-the-road truck drivers or pilots, sort of mission-critical type of workers. But that sort of low productivity can affect anybody's workplace.
That was Dr. Jason Graff joining us from St. Luke's. Haley Prophet and Sean Yu joined us from Garmin when we had that conversation last February. We've brought it out today because we can always use a good night's sleep. Earlier in the hour, we spoke live with Savannah Rogers, whose TED Talk about how the movie Chasing Amy saved her life has actually gotten the attention of the movie's director, Kevin Smith. And he is now helping her make a documentary based on her story. If you missed that, we'll have it online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, affordable housing is an issue in Kansas City, but that's true throughout the nation. We're putting our housing issues in context tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Chris Young, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.